Hello, and welcome to the lies.com podcast. This one's being recorded on Thursday, April 19th, I believe is the date. No, Wednesday, April 19th. And I apologize, I've recorded a new podcast twice since the last one you've heard. And both times I've had a problem with my recording technology that has basically eaten the podcast and prevented me from saving it to disk, which was disappointing in that I think they were actually not bad podcasts, by my standards at least. Anyway, I will keep my fingers crossed and try not to do the things that messed me up last time, and we'll see if this works. I tried upgrading my recording technology somewhat in the interest of avoiding the problem, but so far that upgrade process hasn't gone too well. I bought a device called a Belkin Universal Microphone Adapter for the iPod, and unfortunately it turns out not to be quite as universal as the name would lead you to believe. It doesn't work with any of the three different types of iPods that we have in the house. So I'm back to the drawing board, and back to my original recording method, which in this case means plunking my PowerBook on the passenger seat next to me for my commute and recording directly to it, which I realize is risky in the sense that I could munch my hard drive, which would be bad, and it's also, as experience has shown, risky in the sense that my battery can die before I can save the audio to disk. We'll see how we do. There's been a lot going on, as usual, in the world of politics that I normally obsess over. Say what you will about George Bush, having him as president certainly makes for interesting times, in the Chinese proverb sense. But I think I'm going to give George a break today and not obsess over him, so that you have some taste of George Bush, though. I think I'm going to go ahead after I get this podcast saved and edit into it a little musical interlude. It's been too long since I played some fun music on the lies.com podcast, so I'm going to insert one here. And if all goes well, you will next be hearing from RX of thepartyparty.com. If you're a longtime lies.com listener, you know that we previously featured RX, or more specifically, his mashup of Imagine and Take a Walk on the Wild Side, featuring audio clips of our fearless leader. And he has a similar piece that I really like. Actually, I'm not sure what the title of it is. The chorus is, "Will the Real RX Please Stand Up?" Which may well be the title. If that's not the title, I'll correct myself on the website when I post this. But for now, here is RX, valued lies.com benefactor, with his mashup, "Will the Real RX Please Stand Up?"
Good times, good times, good times, good times, good times, good times.
Ready to go?
Good times,
all right.
Good times.
From the beginning of time in the history of the world, you and I have always been at war. Freedom, fear, God and the devil in a common voice, we are joined together. Some say, oh, we must leave poor George alone. But as a saint of our times has said, I don't give a fuck. Give him a big part. Will the real RX please stand up? 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 My name is RX. My name is RX. RX.
That's news to me.
In today's world, direct communication is a ticket to success. So tonight I propose a plan to destroy you once and for all. In the next 4 years, I will work with my fellow Americans,
take a request
with the ultimate goal, the total control of your soul. Will the real RX please stand up? 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 My name, my name, my every day, every morning. That's my job. And it's hard work. It is hard work. It's hard work. It's incredibly hard. Believe me. But I think it's worth it, Jim. I think it's worth it. Because I know in the long term, it will set such a powerful example that we can look back and say we did our duty. Duty. I can't tell you how big a mistake I think that is. People get their hands up. Shorty, we're the real artists. Please stand up. Show us. Show us. My name
is R.
No doubt about it. It's R.
There's just no doubt in my mind.
My name. My name
is R.
Totally fresh.
R.
Let me say one thing. A message for every American who is 14 or older. I'm running for president. This is going to be a grassroots campaign. Nothing like this has happened. I ask every American to contribute as they are able to do so. For more information about how to make a donation,
get on your internet and follow it up. Talk about
the party.
Party.com.
Yep. Get the party.
Party.com.
Go.
Get on your internet. Get on your internet. Get on your internet and follow it up. Talk about
the party.
Party.com.
Duty.
The party.
Party.com.
I think this will work.
Get on your internet. Get on your internet. We will help you help us.
Fellas, walk in. We're the real R.
Excellent.
Please stand up.
Good times.
We're the real R.
Excellent.
Please stand up.
My name
is R.
Excellent.
We're the real R.
Excellent.
Please stand up.
Yeah, they got me started here.
We're the real R.
Excellent.
Please stand up.
My name
is R.
Excellent.
We're the real R.
Excellent.
Please stand up.
We're
the real R.
Excellent.
Please stand up.
Get up.
We're the real R.
Excellent.
Please stand up.
My name
is R.
Excellent.
We're the real R.
Excellent.
Please stand up.
And I'll do it again.
I'll do it again.
See you later.
Thank you, George. And thank you, RX of thepartyparty.com. Check him out. Something I talked about a lot in the two lost podcasts that I tried to record before this one was a little more detail about my take on the ivory-billed woodpecker rediscovery, and in particular on the recent challenge to that rediscovery. A piece appeared in Science, which is the paper where the original team more than a year ago now, published their announcement of the rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker in the woods of Arkansas. And this piece that appeared recently was a critique, in particular, of the David Luneau video, the Zapruder film, if you will, of the bird-watching set. This is the video taken from the canoe of one of the searchers that shows a little more than 4 seconds of a big black-and-white woodpecker flying away from a tree trunk and flying away from the camera. It's grainy, it's out of focus. It's ambiguous, and it is, in my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of people, the best evidence at this point in support of the claims by those who say that the ivory-billed woodpecker continues to exist. Now, this criticism of that video that appeared a month or so ago now in Science was from several authors, but the principal author was David Allen Sibley. And that makes for a good story, and it's been covered a lot in the media. Sibley is the author of what is arguably the best field guide to North American birds. He is an obsessive birder, bird illustrator, and bird identifier, and really. And I tend to throw the term obsessive around pretty glibly, but in his case, I think it definitely applies. There was a profile of him that I read a few years ago, and I think it was his wife was being quoted and basically said, she was basically saying that she was happy that his books have been so popular and so successful because she says, he could have been obsessed with something else. He could have been obsessed with, mushrooms or something. And he would have devoted his life to studying and illustrating those, and there wouldn't have been any big payoff for them. But in any event, this paper that ran in Science, it amounts to a criticism of the identification of the bird in the Luneau video as an ivory-billed. And what Sibley has said is that He, you know, originally when the Rediscovery was announced, he was excited like everybody else. He didn't really question it. And at one point, not too long ago, he went on a trip to the Arkansas woods in an effort to see the bird. And he knew going in, he wrote, that his odds were low, that, you know, the amount of hours of search time per sighting, it meant that, you know, for a given person going in there for a week or so, the chances of seeing an ivory bill were very, very remote. And he didn't see one. He saw lots of other great birds, and he talked about that in this piece that he wrote. You can read this piece, by the way, at nature.org, the website for the Nature Conservancy, in their ivory-billed woodpecker section. And then he said he came back from his trip, and he sat down and he watched the Luno video again, and he described it as an experience like someone kicking him in the stomach, because he'd been in those woods, he'd been seeing lots and lots of pileated woodpeckers, which are, to a layman's eye, very similar to an ivory-billed woodpecker. And what he realized in looking at the video was that, oh my gosh, what he saw on the screen, what I'm seeing on the screen, that's an ivory-billed woodpecker. That's not a pileated woodpecker. So he wrestled with his conscience for a while. Should he go public about this? Should he not? And he finally decided that he should. So along with some other skeptics, he whipped out this paper, which ran in Science, along with a rebuttal from the authors of the original paper. And as I look at it, as I look at the video, as I look at the critique from Sibley and the rebuttal from the original team, and as I read the book, The Grail Bird, written by Tim Gallagher, one of that team of original rediscoverers, I really find myself surprised that Sibley would go where he does, that he would criticize that the way he does, because I think he's wrong, and I think the evidence clearly shows that he's wrong. The critique itself is from a logical standpoint, kind of sketchy. It's very brief. Sibley, and I say he, I mean Sibley, but all of his co-authors, they assert at one point that the identification of the bird in the video as a pileated woodpecker cannot be completely ruled out, but they seem to magically jump from that to saying that the bird in the video likely is a pileated woodpecker. And they never make clear what the logical basis for that leap is. And I have my own take on where Sibley is coming from with this. And in part it's based on what he wrote in that piece on the nature.org site. Although actually I expressed this view about it. I mean, this was my initial take on it before I read that, so it was more in the way of confirming information rather than something that led me to this point of view. I think what's going on is something that I've seen in expert birders, not all of them, but some of them, over the years. And I wanted to talk a little bit about my own background and history with birding, because it's something that really interests me and that I'm obsessive about. And I don't know that it'll be of particular interest to the kind of people who listen to the Lies.com podcast, but it's what I'm going to talk about. So this thing that I suspect Sibley of being a victim of in this case is something that happens where, as a birder, you go through phases. Okay, when you first start birding, it's very difficult to identify birds. And beginning birders tend to misidentify birds a lot. And there's a desire to see something exciting. There's a desire to see what a birder would characterize as a good bird, quote-unquote, by which we mean a rarity, a bird that is not normally seen in the area where you're seeing it. And again, for a competitive birder, and for certain people it becomes very much a competition, that's what it's all about. It's all about seeing the rare birds. It's about pursuing these good identifications, these identifications of birds that really don't belong there. And from that perspective, of course, seeing an ivory-billed woodpecker really is the Holy Grail. Seeing a bird that everyone believes to be extinct and actually seeing it alive, that's as good an identification as it is possible to get. But again, for someone who has slipped into this competitive attitude towards birding, for someone else to claim to have seen an ivory-billed woodpecker is a challenge. to their sense of self-worth. And I think that's where this kick in the stomach of David Sibley came from. It wasn't so much that Fitzpatrick and Gallagher and Leneau and the rest of the people in that team said they had seen an ivory-billed woodpecker. It was that they were claiming to have seen one when Sibley himself had not. And that might come off as unfair, and I don't think it's that blatant in terms of how Sibley actually thinks about it, but I think on an emotional level, that's a big component of where he's coming from. In my own history of birdwatching, I remember what first got me started in it was my grandmother, my father's mother, Eleanor Kresge Callender, who is no longer with us, but I remember her very fondly. And the particular memory must have been when I was four, maybe five, but certainly no older than that. This was when my parents were still married, and we lived in a house on Hilton Avenue in Redlands, California. And I remember sitting in the backyard with my grandmother, who was out visiting from New Jersey, where she and my grandfather lived. And she pointed out a bird running across the lawn and said, "Do you know what kind of bird that is?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, that's a mockingbird." And I asked her, "Well, how do you know that?" And she said, just watch it. And when it flies, you'll see that it has these big white patches in its wings. And if you look for those, you can always tell a mockingbird. So I think I was probably skeptical. I was something of a skeptical little kid. But I watched this bird, and sure enough, it flew. A few seconds later, it flew up off the lawn, and there were these big white patches in its wings. And I think that was when I was hooked as a bird watcher. And over the years that followed that, up till the age of maybe 8 or 9, I did it sort of casually. I came up with an old beat-up pair of binoculars we had around the house and got myself a field guide. Although for the first several years, I was actually using an Eastern U.S. field guide, not a Western U.S. field guide, because that happened to be the book that we had in the house, which I guess was something that my father had inherited from his childhood back in New Jersey. So I spent some time trying to convince myself that the California towhees, or then they were called the brown towhee, that I was seeing around our house were actually catbirds, because they were, the shape and the size was right, and the rusty under tail coverts was right, but darn, I couldn't convince myself that those brown birds were actually the slate gray birds from the field guide. I tried, really tried hard to convince myself. But eventually I got an actual field guide that showed the birds around where I live. And my parents divorced, and I lived with my father, but I would visit my mother on weekends and summer vacations. She was living, at that point, she was living in Encinitas, which is in North San Diego County. Today it's just solid tract houses. But at the time, her house was the last house as you headed west from this sleepy little surfing town. It was basically the last house at the crest of the hill. And after that was all chaparral, as far to the east as I could see. And I would go hiking in that area, and I remember seeing coyotes and rabbits and quail and roadrunners and lots of different kinds of birds. And that was when I really got into birdwatching. I would go out and I would be gone for hours. I would go out basically all day. And then something kicked it up into an even higher level of interest for me, which was when I was 12, my father, both my parents had remarried, and then when I was 12, my father went through a divorce from his second wife, and in the course of this, he was working in Washington, D.C. as part of a project, and some kind of energy independence project coming out of the Arab oil embargo, which is when this all took place, the aftermath of that, so I guess the early 1970s. And he was working in Washington, D.C. I was sent to live with my grandparents, the same grandmother and her husband, my father's parents, who by this time had moved to Sun City Center in Florida, a retirement community. And I lived with them for most of 6 months when I was 12. And living in a retirement community, there were no other kids around. I mean, there were a few kids who visited sometimes, but I was basically the only child in this whole community. And it actually became something of an issue that you know, visits from grandchildren was fine, but we weren't supposed to live in this place. There were no schools there. I was tutored by my grandfather, which was highly educational. But the other thing I did while I lived there was I birdwatched. And I birdwatched pretty much continuously for 6 months. And it was amazing. You know, I'd never really understood what the big deal was about the spring warbler migration that I always read about in my birding books. Because in California, it's not that dramatic. I mean, it happens and it's there, but it's not like being in Florida in March and seeing a mixed flock of 20 different warbler species in breeding plumage come, you know, moving through the little grove of cypress trees that you're standing in. It's really intense and incredible. I mean, Florida is an amazing destination for birds. And for someone who had been birding strictly in California for several years before, you know, for my entire life before that, there were just so many exotic different birds. It was amazing. It was really an amazing experience. And a lot of people there that I got involved with the local Audubon Society at that point. A biologist at a bird refuge in Tampa Bay named Frank Dunstan was very helpful. He took me out. I got to go out and see laughing gull nesting colonies in Tampa Bay, and reddish egrets were expanding their range northward, and he'd identified them in Tampa Bay, and I got to see them. It was really just an amazing time. And I came back from that time, when I moved back to California, a committed bird watcher, and it really kicked up to a higher level. I'd been saving money, you know, birthday money and Christmas money and, you know, money for mowing lawns or whatever. I took all the money I'd saved and I spent it on a spotting scope, which, if you're a committed bird watcher, a spotting scope is sort of that's like the dividing line between a casual bird watcher and a committed bird watcher. Is you actually have a spotting scope that you're willing to lug around with you to see those distant shorebirds and ducks and things when you know, for those special cases where you have birds a long way away that you can't get closer to. A spotting scope can be really useful. And I ended up doing a lot of birding over the next several years. I was part of an ongoing census of birds at the San Alijo Lagoon. We'd go out every weekend and count up the birds. And I was involved in some Christmas counts. These are the events around Christmas time when you draw these 15-mile diameter circles all over North America, and bird watchers go out on a particular day and identify all the birds they can within the circle, and then they tabulate all the results. And it's actually, you know, from a scientific standpoint, it's really useful. And it's just a lot of fun to participate in. And this one case, one story in particular I want to mention, because it kind of brings me full circle to what I'm talking about with Sibley and this notion of skeptical birding experts. This one year, and I don't think I actually participated in the count this year, but at the Oceanside Vista Carlsbad count, there was something of a controversy this one year, and in the write-up of the count that appeared in the annual issue of American Birds that carries the results of the counts, the California editor, a guy named Guy McCaskey, who continues to be a prominent figure in California birding circles to this day, as far as I know, he had some very negative comments about the Oceanside Vista Carlsbad count. And, you know, with good reason, I'm sure. He talked about how there were many rarities that had been reported as seen as part of the count, and he didn't find the documentation of those rarities to be sufficient. He felt they were, in fact, like many of them were likely to be misidentifications of birds that were not so rare. And he basically went beyond just a warning and actually got fairly personal. I mean, there was an extra element of, there was some zing to it, his editorial comment that appeared alongside the Oceanside Vista Carlsbad count. It wasn't just that he was questioning the accuracy of these sightings. He was questioning the morality of the people who organized and ran it, and it was fairly nasty. Well, the following year, as part of an effort to upgrade this count, there was a big push on the part of its organizers to get more participants, more experienced participants. They, in essence, went out and recruited a lot of bird watchers to participate in this count and bring up the quality. And, you know, I'm not trying to sound conceited, but as part of that process, I was asked if I would participate in it, and I was happy to do so. I mean, really, this was more that John De Beers, this biologist who was organizing the weekly census at Santa Leo Lagoon, invited me to participate, and he was always very nice to me and really helped me feel good. As I mean, birding for me, as this kid who was, you know, I didn't have a great family situation. My father was married, divorced. I felt out of place when I visited my mom. I felt kind of out of place in her family. She had, you know, some new kids, my half-brother and half-sister. And as a kid growing up, it just felt, you know, I felt out of place a lot. And this community of bird watchers that I ended up spending a lot of time with, in some ways, provided some of the acceptance I felt I was seeking for. I don't know. I mean, I look at it that way in hindsight. I mean, it was sort of a bittersweet experience for me. I always felt out of place with them, too. You know, here I was in this group of adults getting together every week, and they'd have these potlucks after they went out and did the bird census, where they'd get together for lunch, and they'd go over, they'd tabulate all the birds they'd seen. And I always just felt really uncomfortable. I'm also just, you know, if you do a personality, when I've done personality assessments, I'm basically off the scale in terms of introversion. And I think that's a lot of, you know, I think that colors my memories of the time, that colored my experience at the time. But it's a reason why I loved birdwatching so much, because it was something I could go out and do on my own. You know, in a way, I think that birds were like surrogate friends or surrogate family. They were familiar, you know, I got to know them. I didn't have to feel uncomfortable around them. I don't know. A lot of this, I guess, is psychobabble, and I wasn't aware of a lot of this at the time. But anyway, so this Christmas count happens, this Oceanside Vista Carlsbad count happens, and John De Beers and the other people in that group, they were nice enough to ask me to participate, and I had a great time, saw some great birds. You had to document, you know, there was a list of birds that you know, they would just accept that you saw them because they were expected to be there. But then there was a supplemental list of birds. If you saw those, you needed to provide some sort of written documentation, you know, to provide the basis of your identification. And I think I had two or three birds that were good enough, in quotes, to require that documentation. And all those sightings were accepted. Prairie falcon and a bittern and something else. Ibis, maybe? Glossy ibis? White-faced ibis? I don't remember. It was a long time ago. But the incident I actually want to talk about, it was the day after the count. And this is something that happens at a Christmas count. You know, the day of the count, you split up your available manpower into all these different little areas, and you go out and you've got, you know, hopefully if you're really organized, you've staked out good birds, you know where they are, so on the count day you can go reacquire them efficiently. But you've got your team split up and you divide up the area. You know, 15-mile diameter circle is a lot of area to cover. And so your team typically has, you know, an assignment. You have a particular small area. But then the day after the count, especially for the people who are obsessive, you go out again and you hit all the highlights. You go and you try and reacquire those birds, not for the count, but just for your own, you know, birding enjoyment. You go out and you try and see all those really good birds that were seen by other teams the previous day. And as part of that, we were out there at a mission or some interesting building that they'd seen an olive-sided flycatcher at. And an olive-sided flycatcher is not a great rarity, but it's not normal to see it. It doesn't typically overwinter in California. So to get an olive-sided flycatcher for the Christmas count was actually considered a really good bird. So we were out there the next day, and groups of us were wandering around, and I was with John and some other folks. And at one point, you know, we found it. We found this. There was a flycatcher in the top of a tree, and we're checking it out, and we're chatting with each other about, oh, yeah, there it is. You know, there's its field marks. There's that thick body and that shortish tail, and especially the sort of olive sides, the sort of olive vest pattern that the bird has on its flanks. And so we're looking at it, we're talking about it, and Guy McCaskey was there. He participated in the count, and in his write-up of the count that year, as nasty as he was the previous year, he was that effusive in his praise for the count this year, where he talked about how what a great turnaround there'd been and how it was so much more reliable and such a better job. And as someone who knew the role that he had played in organizing the count that year, it was obvious that what he was basically doing is he was congratulating himself. I mean, there was just so much ego in both those years' write-ups that I found it kind of off-putting. But anyway, to return to the day after the count, we're standing there looking at the bird, we're watching it, when Guy McCaskey comes walking up. He's got some, it was like a toy poodle, some little dog he carried around with him, sort of like, it was just such a picture of sort of foppish, egomaniacal kind of, I don't know the guy. I just know him from, this is the only time I ever really experienced him, but he came walking up and he raised his binoculars and looked at the bird and announced to us with this air of just incredible pomposity, "Oh yes, that is the olive-sided flycatcher." And the rest of us kind of exchanged smirks. You know, it was just funny. It was like, you know, we didn't actually have any doubt at that point. We did not need you to come up and put your imprimatur on this, but that is what he was doing. And I can actually trace my leaving. I gave up bird watching shortly after that, and really didn't do it for years and years. And I think it really, my falling out of love with birdwatching that happened around that time was really born in that moment. I mean, it was a reaction to that. I was seeing my future. You know, I was seeing this pompous, egotistical, kind of sad guy for whom the birdwatching wasn't about seeing birds. It was about status, and it was about a competition. It was a zero-sum game. You know, in order for him to succeed, other people had to fail. And it was basically a competition over who could be more skeptical. Basically, you know, the attitude he displayed was along the lines of, well, if I didn't see it and I didn't identify it, then it isn't really there. I'm not going to accept your identification because you are below me in this great hierarchy of birding status. And I've worked hard to get to this position. I've climbed that ladder rung by rung, and I'm now at a point where I don't need to accept anybody else's identification, because everybody else, by definition, is below me, and if I did not see and identify the bird, chances are it isn't really there. And I believe that a similar psychology is operating in the case of Sibley's criticism of the identification of the ivory-billed woodpecker. There's a lot more specifics to why I think the Fitzpatrick team, the rediscovery team, is right and Sibley is wrong. There's several aspects, at least, of the video that Sibley dismisses without really treating them seriously, and I think they tend to really undercut his criticism. There's also the question of the eyewitnesses. There's at least three or four separate sightings that are very well documented that have occurred, you know, that had occurred in the year or two before the announcement of the rediscovery, that, you know, basically, if you either have to argue that those people are intentionally lying, or you have to accept that they really did see an ivory-billed woodpecker. And Sibley basically just dismisses all of that out of hand because it's non-repeatable, it's non-verifiable. And this, again, I think, is a hallmark of the kind of out-of-control skepticism that characterizes the most obsessive, competitive birders. You know, it's possible, and I've said this on lies.com in other contexts, but I think the story really does illustrate this, that you can be wrong by being too skeptical, just as you can be wrong by being too credulous. That quote from, I want to say Carl Sagan, I'm not sure who it's from, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, really isn't scientific. I mean, as a description of a failing of human nature, sure, I'll accept it. But it's not that extraordinary claims should require extraordinary proof. Proof, by definition, is all the proof you need for a truly objective scientific assessment. And to arbitrarily impose a need for extraordinary proof in cases where, for whatever subjective reasons, you happen to believe very strongly that the thing being proposed is not true, isn't scientific. In fact, if you look at all the great scientific breakthroughs, or if you look at, you know, philosophy of science, and you look at Kuhnian scientific revolutions and all, you know, the unwillingness to accept extraordinary claims without quote-unquote extraordinary proof is a hallmark of those people who have resisted the great advances in science. If the evidence supports it, the scientific position is, yeah, that's the new reality. That's the new theory we're going to go with here. If it happens to be remarkable or it happens to contradict other evidence, then you weigh it in the balance and you decide which is the most likely, and you go with the most likely explanation, or you come up with some assessment of how confident you can be. And to me, what Sibley is doing in the case of the ivory-billed woodpecker is he's saying basically, I really don't believe this bird exists. I really want to believe it doesn't. And so I'm going to dismiss out of hand a lot of evidence just because I would rather cling to my a priori belief. And I don't think that's scientific. And in this case, I think he's wrong. You know, skepticism to the point of error is not a virtue. And I think people who get caught up in skepticism as a sort of religious faith, as something that they cling to, as a good in and of itself, fool themselves and lie to themselves and subject themselves to error. It took me many years to get past my own emotional repugnance for that particular approach to birdwatching and resume my love affair with birds. And fittingly, it was my wife, Linda, who really brought me back to bird watching. When we were first together, there was a morning I'll always remember where we were listening to birdsong outside the window, and she said, "Oh, listen to that, you know, listen to those owls." And I said, "Well, actually, those aren't owls. Those are spotted doves." And we went on from that to identify all the other bird songs we were hearing. She imitated a, you know, she said, "Oh, really? So you know bird songs?" Like, "Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that was, when I birdwatched a lot, identifying birds by ear was one of the things I really focused on and really worked at." And she said, "Well, what's this bird that I always hear that goes like this? You know, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo- it was just a lot of fun to sort of rediscover birding with someone who was excited about it and didn't have all the emotional baggage that I had connected with it. I'll always remember going birdwatching the first time with Linda, officially going birdwatching, not just lying there listening to bird songs. And we went to Will Rogers State Park up in Pacific Palisades, and we got out of the car and there were some birds flitting around on the ground, and we watched them, we looked at them in our binoculars, and they were juncos, what I would think of from my childhood as Oregon juncos, but officially these days they are the dark-eyed junco. And so we were watching these juncos, and this was a real eye-opener for me, because this was the kind of bird that I would have identified and moved on from in a second, or maybe 2 seconds at most, back when I was so focused on competitive birding. And to Linda, they were amazing and beautiful, and she was watching them and she was excited about them and she was describing them, and it was great. And I came to appreciate juncos for the first time in decades, and it was, as I say, it was a real eye-opener for me, and it really brought me back to birding and bird watching, and I'm very grateful to Linda for that. It was a valuable lesson, and one that I think everybody would benefit from learning. You know, to slow down and open your eyes and really see what's in front of you. In any event, I'm going to slow down and open my eyes and pay attention to my driving. I want to thank you for listening to this Lies.com podcast. It is copyrighted and distributed under a Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. Thank you very much to RX of thepartyparty.com. And thank you again for listening. I'm John Callender, and I will see you next time.